You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca, and this is the Made of Clay Report. And our guest on this hour is Michael Hilbig. Did I pronounce that correctly?
You did pronounce it nicely.
Okay. Michael, you are locally known as Hilbig, mostly, so that people will recognize that name as well. But I will alternate back and forth out of respect both for your origins and for your current life.
Yeah, that's correct. I mean, sure. Most people will probably also recognize me on my accent, which is very tough to hide. So there it is.
Yeah,
if you can't hide it, highlight it, I guess. People know me as Hilbig, also as a skinny German juggle boy. That's what I do for a living.
Uh-huh.
That's part of who I am here in the community, and I live here, and I perform here at times. And I definitely made Ithaca my home, that's for sure, yeah.
So, tell us a little bit more about yourself. What do we need to know to start this conversation to get to know each other?
Well, I'm a father, I'm a lover, I'm a juggler, and I'm a really nice guy once you get to know me.
And how did you... So we'll start with there. We're going to cut to music, unless there's a story you want to say to tell us that helps to kind of also flesh out those qualities that you just listed.
I've been looking for that story all my life. I can tell you many stories, and then you can make up your own picture.
Sure.
So who am I?
Who are you? Yes, that's
who
the question.
Who am I? It's either you don't know who I physically am, or that's a very deep question, at which point I must ponder. But who am I? Who am I right now? Who was I yesterday? Who was I like last year ago? I'm many different people. And,
absolutely.
And I'm evolving as the journey goes along.
Right. And so some people take the question as what are the qualities that are evolving? Or, you know, as opposed to what are the labels that change?
Apparently,
some people take it lots of different ways.
I can tell you definitely who I think I would like me to be, and
sure,
who I see me being at times, in my good times, and that's like a compassionate, loving, understanding. I'm a good listener, apparently, and I'm very neutral when it comes to issue. People call me Switzerland at times rather than Germany.
Right.
And I'm tall, my hips are still working, and I'm almost 50. These are definitely great qualities
yes,
to have.
Yes, they are. Yeah.
I'm a good cook.
Uh-huh.
I like to garden.
Uh-huh.
I watch home improvement shows when I have a chance. I don't have television at home, but I do
when you're
I'm
on the road.
And family, you know, many people probably say that. That's how I really see myself, because otherwise you just look in the mirror otherwise. But I see myself through my family and spending time with them as much as I can.
Cool. And you brought music with you. And a lot of it is German, right?
Some of it is German. Some of it is definitely 80s.
Yeah.
Definitely a theme that's going to go through that music.
So do you want to say something about the Style Council and Shout to the Top?
That's our music when I was a teenager, when, you know, like all these like new emotions and feelings come up. And that was basically the soundtrack to it. And for some reason, I always... like all the music I always liked, I still like it, even strange stuff.
Even though
like,
you've grown out of it
I don't
in
know,
some
I,
ways.
I meet
yeah,
people
yeah.
sometimes and they tell me about their music choices when they were teenagers or younger, and now they despise the music at times or hate it. And I never quite understood it. For me, like pretty much all the music, I still somewhat enjoy it at some level. And I listen to the Smurf album, the original one, to give you an idea.
Yes,
but,
yeah,
you know,
yeah,
I can still take that one too. So it's basically the soundtrack of my youth.
Okay, well, here we go. The Style Council, Shout to the Top. And I'm not sure what we got going on.
Thank you.
You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca, and this is the Made of Clay Report. And our guest on this hour is Michael Hilbig, or Hilby. So, Michael, tell me, what are some of the, I mean, from your accent, you know, and from the fact that you're from Germany, how did you get here? How did you come to stay here? That's one narrative that we can go into. And the other narrative is, what are some experiences that really helped to shape you? I mean, for some people, the move is not important, but the life is.
It was all important, and it's quite a lovely story, yeah. And love was a big part of it as well. I met the mother of my children, my first wife in the United States, overseas in Pakistan, and she was on an international peace walk, where they walked literally around the world in stages, and they have walked across the United States, and then several of them continued, they called Walk for a Livable World. They continued through Europe and then through Asia, and while they were in Islamabad, I was there at the same time. On my own journey, and we fell in love, uh-huh. And I decided to continue the journey with them together. That stopped then in Hiroshima, walking from Tokyo to Hiroshima to remembrance of the August 6th atom bomb drop, and that was the end of their journey, and that was then after over a year for me walking with them, made a decision what we want to do, where we want to live, and Abigail, she had very strong ties to this area here in Ithaca. That's where she grew up. She had a very strong family bond and a great family, and she really wanted to return to the family and see. And I wanted to give it a shot. See, we wanted to settle down. We came here, and it was at the same time where her mother, who's a visionary and a great person overall, was part in organizing Eco Village. And I don't know if you're familiar with the co-housing community on West Hill. And we were very excited and became part of it from day one, and had been part of it then for 15 years till we separated. And we both then still lived up there. Now we both live in Fall Creek, but that's a different story. So that was the reason love brought me to Ithaca.
Sure.
And I must say, from the very first day, I can still remember the emotions and the feelings I had when I drove in here with a night bus from New York City coming from Japan. Never having been here.
And what year was that?
That was in 93.
Okay.
Yeah, in October 93. And it was like in the beginning of October.
Uh-huh.
Fall was just happening. And fall is my favorite time, autumn, in upstate New York, in many areas, but especially here. It's one of my favorite time for so many reasons. And I don't know if you can say I fell in love with it, but I was in love with the situation of like settling down and being somewhere, and also being with a woman I loved, and you know, having a kid on the way, and wanting to see if I can make it.
Sure.
Yeah.
Sure.
That's how I ended up originally here.
And what keeps you here?
What keeps me here is, I don't know if I have a top 10 list, but I can give you a few reasons. One of them, number one is, my kids love it here, and it's a great place to have kids, Ithaca, mm-hmm. in general. Yeah, like, no, Eco Village even magnified the community spirit of Ithaca itself. And it was also designed in a way where it's great to bring up kids. There's no immediate traffic in front of your houses. It's 180 acres of wood in nature, in ponds, and other children's to play with. And there was no question in my mind, as long as we are together, Eco Village is the place to be, especially for the children. Mm-hmm. And then after we separated, we went our both ways and we went to Fall Creek, which I guess is as close as you can get to Eco Village without actually having a co-housing community.
Right, right.
You tear up the streets and you're pretty much there. And I just love everything about Ithaca. You have everything you need. You have the Four Seasons. You have all sorts of people. You know, extreme fringes of expressions mm-hmm. here in Ithaca, and tolerated for the most part, I would say. It's great for outdoor activities. Mm-hmm. You have the water element. You have great food. You have funky little tea shops and coffee shops and movie theaters. And Cornell and Ithaca College offers you plenty of opportunity to get big town entertainment. Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. yeah, love it.
Yeah. So, and what are your ties to Germany at this point in your life?
Well, my entire family lives there, and I'm the only one who ever left. And unfortunately, I don't get to go much because I'm the lost cousin, brother, son who moved to the United States. And when they see New York in the address, they always assume I'm in New York City.
Right.
So
right.
I get every single family member visiting me, which is great, but that means I don't get to go much, mm-hmm. which will change in a few weeks. I'm going.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. And is there a special occasion for this particular trip?
Yeah, seeing my father in particular, and of course my mom as well, but basically seeing my dad, and also my son is studying over there right now in Berlin.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh. All right. How many siblings do you have?
I have 3 siblings myself,
okay.
yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Cool. Cool. So how did you find your way into being how do you describe your career? You're the skinny German juggle boy.
Yeah, but it's fluid.
It's fluid. Cuz it's some clowning and it's some juggling, it's all sorts of
it's a package. It's a full show. It's well, to describe the show itself, I mean, the skinny German juggle boy sort of does that for you in a sense. I'm skinny, I'm German, and I juggle. And the title sort of like, that's funny. He's German. How is that possible? So I'm playing on the stereotype of Germans not supposed to be funny. And it wasn't a career choice. My guidance counselor didn't say to me, like, you should be a skinny German juggle boy. Far from it.
So how did you discover it?
I was a social worker in Germany. That's uh-huh. what I went to school for, and I wanted to continue my studies. My grades went good enough to be immediately accepted into the next program. So I was put on a waiting list for 6 months, for 1 semester, and I decided to travel.
And you went to Islamabad.
I just never came back. And it was important for me back then. My friend and I really wanted to do everything overland. Uh-huh. So we wanted to go to Asia. So just get to Asia, it almost took us 6 months. By the time we took the Trans-Siberian train at the end. And
who were we when you started?
My bestest friend, I like that word, bestest. My bestest uh-huh. friend, Rico, him and I, we decided to travel together. And there were many reasons why we had to leave. Some of them we had to leave and some we wanted to leave. But we did leave, and both of us sort of never came back in that sense. And once we were in Asia, I learned how to juggle. I also ran out of money. And by default, when you're in many Asian countries or overseas in general, you stand out of who you are as a foreigner, a tall person, as a blonde person perhaps. And then you put on top of it dreadlocks and hippie clothing and fancy juggling equipment. And you have an audience, which you would have anyhow in many instances. But now you have an audience who actually watches you do stuff. And I didn't mind it. I quite enjoyed it, actually. And I did it whenever I could, and I received pleasure. And then all of a sudden, when I went to certain areas where people could afford it, I received money as well. And I said, well, like, this is awesome, so to speak. And I continued the journey with the money I made on the street. And I knew that if I do settle, I want to give it a shot and see what I can achieve with that.
Yeah, yeah. And this was in the early 1990s.
That was in the early 90s. Yeah, I learned how to juggle in India. And as I said in the beginning, I just did it because I loved it, and I still do love it. I knew that this is something I want to explore to the extent I could. But I quite enjoyed what it did to me physically. It got me literally got you out of your chair. You
Absolutely,
have to somewhat
yes.
stand up for juggling most of the time. And I get to meet lots of different people. I like the community of jugglers. I mean, there's so many reasons why I still like it and why I got into it. But quite frankly, it also allowed me to pay the bills. And
yes.
I saw the power in that, being able to do something you most of the time love, but even if you don't like it, it's still good for you.
It's good exercise at the very least.
It's still fun and it's still great. Yeah. And it has most of the time, it just has positive impact, especially when you do it on the street. The money you make is really from the people who enjoyed your product.
Right.
It's not like other products. You buy them and take them out of the package mm-hmm. and it's foul and you regret the moment you bought it. With street performing, you don't have these customers. They don't
right.
pay. They usually just walk away. So all you get is like the positive feedback and the people who enjoyed it. So that helps.
Oh, yeah.
Definitely.
Oh, yeah. So you were open to figuring out how to make your travels work as well as to make your life work. And it came together.
Yeah, I was open to that. And also, I was also done with traveling itself. It's one of the easiest thing one can do in a sense. Because your responsibility literally is only to get up. If you can afford it to travel, then really, I mean, you don't have to call anybody in the morning. You don't have to show up anywhere in the morning. You
right.
don't have to bring people somewhere, pick them up somewhere. It's all yours a day. It's very easy.
And
but
those you're traveling with, that's
yeah.
where the things come into play.
And so it can become an empty form of expressing yourself unless you fill it with meaningful things. At least that's how I feel about myself. I'm
uh-huh.
sure it's different for other people. And juggling was like the perfect filler of the void at that time.
Right, right, right. And you're still a traveler.
Well, the nature of what I do is, unfortunately, Ithaca is not really hot on the vaudeville and entertainment circuit in that sense. And not many cities in the US are. So you have to go where the opportunities are for you. And I diversify my portfolio, so to speak. I you see me anywhere you would see entertainment.
Where do you perform?
I'm somewhat pride. I don't know if I say pride myself, but you can see me on top on cruise ships. I work on cruise ships.
Sure.
I just got back from a cruise ship. You can see me in elementary schools. You can see me on the street. You can see me at casinos, at cooperative events. And I always liked that about it gives me diversity of where
sure.
I can go and which people I get to meet. But also job security in the sense that if one industry goes down, I still have the other. And but yeah, as I said, I liked it also. I liked the challenge of being able to make a 3-year-old have a great time and their great 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 grandparents as well having an awesome time.
Yeah, an 80-year-old or 90-year-old
exactly.
right next to them.
That's
sure.
somewhat important to me. And also I think that's a bit of the attraction and why
uh-huh.
my show is popular enough that I be able to do it most places I want to.
What is it that draws you to want to reach the breadth, both in terms of age, but also, I imagine, in terms of culture and background of people that you can. What keeps you?
I think it's really genuine love for people and,
uh-huh.
and the desire to learn and desire to expose yourself and express yourself. And for some reason, I'm not intimidated by what people think of me so mm-hmm. much, especially not in public so much. So that helps. And I quite enjoy what you can get out of people when
yes.
if you talk to them in the right way and if you present yourself in the right way and in the moments you can share together without having to talk about it and just by doing what you love to do. And luckily when I go to work, so to speak, I don't like the word work, but when I go to do my stuff, people clap for me. They give me prizes and awards. I mean, it's a pretty nice job description. Most
yeah.
people don't have that luxury. And I don't know if that's the reason why I do it, but it's nice.
Yeah, yeah. I'm playing here with words running through my head. It's not work, but it's also not a performance that you do for others. It's an engagement that you have with them for the time that you're together.
And I think that's what speaks to people. I have often people come up to me and say me and I take it as a compliment how they say like, part why I really enjoyed watching you is because you seem to enjoy yourself so much doing
yeah.
it. And for me, that's very important. If I see somebody loving what they do, they don't have to be all that good at it necessarily for me
mm-hmm.
to enjoy the service. you know, my if my coffee is mediocre and the person who made it made my heart grow bigger and make, give me a smile, then I don't really mind so much.
It's a wonderful coffee.
Yeah, and it's still a good coffee, you know. That same cup of coffee can be the most disgusting cup of coffee. If, you know what I'm getting
at.
Yeah,
no, I know exactly what you're getting
at. It's what you take out, people receive, and usually that's what gets reflected back as well. I firmly believe in that.
And I guess let's cut to music, and I want to come back to some of these themes. But
sure.
What would you like to play next?
Why don't we play Nena, 99 Luftballons. Everyone knows that.
Yes.
Hast du etwas Zeit für mich? Dann singe ich ein Lied für dich vom 99 Luftballons auf ihrem Weg zum Horizont. Denkst du vielleicht grad an mich? Dann singe ich ein Lied für dich vom 99 Luftballons und das, was von sowas kommt. Hey,
WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca, and our guest on this hour of the Made of Clay Report is Mishael Hilbig. Mishael, how did you come to consciousness of how your respect for people and engagement of them is what kind of roots your practice of entertainment?
How? I don't know. I mean, that's
when did that become a conscious story for you? Because it happens over people's lives.
For me, it's empathy. I think it all boils down to empathy.
Well, that's the connection.
And I do actually remember as a teenager, it was during the Chinese uprising. I think.
Feeling
really emotional about something that was really far removed from me, and I tried to figure out what the words are, and actually looked up empathy in the dictionary, Which is very similar in German, the word. And then I say, that's what it is. That's what that feeling is. And I don't know if it started back then, but that's the first time I became self-aware of it and wanted to know what that feeling is. Mm-hmm. And I think that's been a common thread, that I do have a good idea what's going on with other people and what it takes for me to be nice to them. Which I don't know if that comes from being on stage a lot and knowing what kind of responses I get if I say certain things, or if it's just like a life skill that sort of grows as you go along.
Well, I would imagine that if you are open to engaging others, then and you have a lot of opportunities to practice, eventually you're going to figure it out.
Yeah, what loves each other finds each other. I really believe in that. Yeah, no, if you put it out there, it comes back. And then you learn from this experience and you see how it works. It's like a magic trick almost. Even so, it's not magic. It's pretty right there in front of you.
But it's magic to people who don't know how to trust.
Oh, this isn't it incredible? I mean, just like smiling.
Yeah.
You know, even if you force yourself, it does really make a difference. And then you find yourself wanting to do it anyhow because it's just such an impact usually. It sounds very simple, but I mean, it does work.
Yes, yes. What have you learned over the course of your life that you didn't expect you would have to learn?
You know, that classic thing that am I coming to be more conservative? Or is my conservatism that maybe where I feel like I'm becoming more conservative, it's just that I resign myself of the possibilities that change could happen. You know, where one becomes so bitter of like decades of seeing things not changing, that one maybe then adopts sometimes, I don't know if it's out of laziness or because you resign, positions that you wouldn't have taken maybe 20 years ago, because you would maybe have the energy and will and power and hope that these things might change.
Do you want to give some example to that, or what do you mean by that?
What I mean by this, like, I mean, for example, we bought the very first Prius. And when I say the very first Prius, we really bought the very first Prius.
If I recall correctly, yeah.
And to the point where we would be pulled over by a police officer because we wanted to look under the hood, just wanted to see the car. We were constantly, I mean, not to brag, but for me, it was always important, like, don't preach, just show people what one can do.
Sure.
And hopefully that's be contagious and it works that way. And it works definitely with comedy. We always had the Prius, and now, after it's been like what 15 years almost of having hybrid cars, when the last one broke, it's like how much of a difference did it make? So we ended up not buying another hybrid car, and I was wondering if I was like, am I sort of resigning to hope, or what is it? Becoming more conservative in the way I live, the way I want to show myself in public of what I can do, and you know, that's one of the examples.
Right. I guess there's a transition that happens, especially with people who have a strong sense of wanting to impact the world, where you have to learn the difference between your values, which may be for change, but how they get mixed up with vanity, and that participation in change is your symbol, and you may see that things don't work quite the way that you thought they would, so you pull back, because you also learn a lot more about suffering. And about grieving that things don't happen quite in the way that we thought they would when we got up and raised the flag.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
And we can call that conservative. We can also call that somewhat repentant and kind to ourselves and others who didn't necessarily buy into what we were selling, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, I will adopt. Yeah. Oh yeah, kindness over conservatives, and luckily I'm somewhat well self-aware of it, and I'm trying to do other things. But yeah, it's like, have you given up just because you haven't seen it come through, or are you getting just physically more tired? And
you're talking about resignation. Have you become more resigned?
Yeah, exactly.
And we, as a nation, in this particular moment, in this spring of 2016, we are flirting between resignation and rage as a nation. And what we're avoiding in either of those responses, from my point of view, we're avoiding grief.
Grief and responsibility,
Both.
And for that matter, I must say.
But you have to grieve when things didn't work out the way you wanted them to, rather than take yourself out with resignation or make yourself ineffective with rage.
Or become angry.
Angry and enraged. You have to grieve, to feel the loss of something that didn't happen that you really may have wanted.
But you still want it to happen. But you're still going to have to do something about that.
But grief allows something different to happen than your misplaced hope of the past. And that is because it didn't work out.
Yeah.
And that's the grief process allows it to come through. We don't have, in either our religious circles or in our entertainment circles, people who can help us grieve to get over ourselves and pick up and dust ourselves off and move into the next phase.
They're far in between, let's put it this way.
They're few and far between.
They do exist, I do myself.
Okay, help me to understand. Willie Nelson played that kind of role during the farm crisis back in the 1970s and early 80s because he allowed a lot of working class white men to identify with the destruction of their lifestyle and the possible picking up of something different.
And he was very hands-on in so many ways, not only expressing, verbalizing what other people couldn't, but then also helping on the ground financially.
Yeah.
And with his honesty, I must say, that's what I like most about him.
And he sang across genres, African-American blues standards and classic, you know, country.
If it sounds
folk
good, it is good.
And Broadway musical stuff, yeah, yeah.
I must say, that's the one thing, people ask me, if you do it again in show business, would... And then I would say to incorporate more music, just because there's so much more to pick up with music. There's so much more interaction happening.
What is there to pick up that you can't do with your other shows?
With the juggling, you can. But I mean, for just to give you an example, when six jugglers meet, there's really only so many patterns you can go through.
If
six musicians meet, there's quite a few more patterns one can explore and indulge in and play with. The improvisational aspect of music, I think, is a bit more pronounced and amplified than it is in juggling.
Although, yes, and I would agree, the different emotional tones, the different messages, the different genre, the different ways in which you can engage and experience in music are huge, but you can also do that with attitude and delivery.
You can do it with subtlety. I mean, I must say, most of the time, there's not much depth to my shallowness when it comes to comedy. It's very simple and plain in that sense.
It's clean and more accessible.
Clean to the point where I usually don't offend people. And if I do, it's usually stuff I'm more than happy to repeat right after the show. It's not something I regret.
Yeah.
I do sometimes say things that might be making people uncomfortable, but not necessarily on purpose. But I really do believe in some of my jokes. And sometimes I get offended when people get offended.
Right.
Because I think they get offended for the wrong reasons.
And you're human.
And it's very bad. You should never do that. You should never show that in a show. People don't like seeing that. But I have certain comedy routines that people... Yeah, and also times are changing. Yeah. People look different at things, at issues especially. Yeah.
So you brought up the notion of feeling perhaps more conservative. And what is comforting about that and what is scary about that for you?
Well, comforting, I can't say that it's necessarily comforting. But I'm also a realist. I can look at it, I can step back and look at it. It's like, that of course that's the way you feel because you've been through a few decades of not much having changed. And you sometimes wonder, what does it really take? And I remember talking to a dear friend of mine, and she always got very frustrated by how she felt the low impact her life has on the world. And I kept reminding her, it's like, look, if everyone would live the way the life you do, then everything would just be fine. And that's a huge impact to have, I think, to know that what you do, if that would be replicated by most other humans in the industrial world, we do actually much better. And as long as I know that, I feel okay, I can handle it. And I don't feel I'm all that conservative in comparison to what my ideas and hopes were, perhaps.
Yeah.
But also, if you look at the real life impact of now and what I had back then, it's much bigger. Like, mm-hmm. Back then, I wasn't able to sponsor a child to go to school in an impoverished country. Back then, I didn't have the skill or know-how how to have a functioning compost and an organic garden.
Sure.
And to do a lot of home improvement projects that are green and also creative. So yes and no. Like, maybe I do feel a bit further removed from some of the ultimate goals, but I'm definitely closer to the things I can do and mm-hmm. I wanted to do in mm-hmm. certain mm-hmm. respect.
So the life that you live, even though you may be traveling on ocean liners and truck cars and planes, the life you live in some ways is closer in front of your face and not so far out there in terms of your ability to engage.
I have to, in a sense, because it sounds great when you talk to somebody on the plane, when they ask you what you do for a living and you say you work on cruise ships and then, oh, how exciting, you fly. But also, quite frankly, I don't think a grown-up man should spend that much time by himself. So I do that also in order to protect myself from, there's a lot of time, downtime. You wouldn't choose to be at a particular place in time. So I'm a realist in that sense too, that I keep myself busy and I work on projects because I'm not necessarily where I want to be.
Right. Tell me more about that. What is it about living the life you live that is not where you would ideally want to be as a man of your age?
To give you an example, like I do cruise ships.
Sure.
And I love the cruise ship industry. They give me a lot of great opportunities. And I love doing shows. The theaters are magnificent. They're wonderful.
Exquisitely designed, wonderful spaces. The food
is great. The techs are great. You only work 2 hours a week. And there's life in the problem. You have a lot of time to become a chain-smoking alcoholic if you choose to, because all the elements are there. People
right.
who like to party on a constant basis, that's what they do on chips. There's lots of food, there's lots of cheap alcohol. So in other words, I could just let go and see if I can enjoy that life, but I know also what it does to people and what it does to your head. So I keep myself busy, but it's difficult at times because you have a lot of time to have your mind wander about uh-huh, things uh-huh. you don't wonder about usually because you're busy cooking,
right.
cleaning, picking, dropping off, working in the garden or whatever it is that keeps you busy and away from these kind of thoughts. And that's at times tough, I must say, being on the road and having really a lot of time that's in your head.
So when you first ran into this problem, how did you deal with it?
Becoming a hypochondriac, all of a sudden you have time to think about things you wouldn't, like little spots on your body
right,
and so
right.
forth. Or have I done the right decision? What would have happened if I have done that? Where you
second
can like
guessing
really
yourself.
Go through and
yeah.
you can make your whole movie. Things you usually just do when you lay at bed at night or so forth, or when you're driving. Now you can do 24/7 when you have jobs like on a cruise ship. And I'm talking plainly for me. I must be
sure,
really clear
yeah.
about it. Everyone else on the ship works extremely hard. I'm really the only one who
but
doesn't.
You're one of the entertainers and they have a different schedule.
I work 2 hours a week, yeah. I'm the only one who can go to work and say I'll be back in a short while, yeah.
Yeah. Wow. So what do you do to keep your mind occupied, to keep your heart centered and your body in shape? What do you do? I mean, this is coming a little earlier in the conversation yeah. than I normally do, but I never thought about your having that kind of freedom, and really it's isolation.
It is very isolated in a sense, and I do enjoy sometimes the motion of not having spoken a word
uh-huh.
for days at a time. I quite enjoy that at times. But I do read a lot. I have a schedule. I exercise. I do yoga on a daily basis, especially when I'm on the road. And I like to run and do other cardiovascular exercises. I walk on the ship to get fresh air. I do my reading. I have a bit of a schedule. And I usually bring an activity with me on the ship, like an instrument
uh-huh.
or something I want to learn. I'm learning Spanish right now with Rosetta Stone. So I do my activities and see if I keep in the schedule. And then once I do my show, I like talking to people. I really do enjoy hearing other people's stories. And everyone has a story, as I say. And on the cruise ship, you know, you have so many different nationalities from different places coming together. And once they've seen your show, again, they only come to you if they like it, liked it.
Right, that's true.
They don't make an effort usually to come. It's like, you know what, I really didn't like your show. And no, they don't express that. People come to you are coming with an open mind and an open heart usually. And they're interesting people and you get into conversation. So I talk a lot on the ship then. Even so, I enjoy the times before my show where I don't talk. Once mm-hmm. you've done a performance, everybody recognizes you.
Everybody knows yeah. you. Yes, yeah. yes, yes. And how many days? I mean, where in the course of the cruise does your show come? Near the middle, the beginning, the
it
end?
It depends on the cruise director yeah. and what yeah. he finds reasonable and what fits.
Sure.
And I have a workshop I do too. I like teaching juggling. I do really believe that juggling is a gift that came to me and really showed me a lot of things I would have never seen perhaps.
How so?
Well, number one, it showed me the physical act of juggling itself, which is quite amazing. I don't know, you juggle?
No, I have a little bit. I like with most things for me, I have to turn off my mind yeah. and become a responsive, in the moment, physical being. And yeah. when I do that, the juggling comes easily.
Exactly. And that's like many other things like music perhaps sure. or other artistic ways you can express yourself with your body. Once you be able to control the environment around you, if that's with like juggling equipment or with an instrument or so forth, the power that comes over you and the ease and enjoyment and the living in the moment, there's so many metaphors for it, you know.
Sure.
It's just priceless. It's just gold. It's time spent without worries, time spent without having to think about the future, just in the now. And I never forget what a gift it is. And I have my juggling equipment with me all the time,
mm-hmm.
always something in my pocket to physically engage myself in it. And I think it's great to see people learning how to juggle. And then also all of a sudden you have a gift to give to other people.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, I mean, there's no bad side effect of juggling. I have yet to meet somebody who's like, you know, ever since I started juggling, life has just not been the same. It's been going down the tubes. It's a gift for anyone.
Yeah, yeah. I want to come back to that. Let's take a little music break.
Sure.
Shall we go to The Clash?
Absolutely.
Okay.
We'd always go to The Clash.
Okay, here we go. It's Complete Control. Clash and Complete Control, and you're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca, and this is the Made of Clay Report, and our guest on this hour is Mishael Hilbig, or Hilby, as he's commonly known here. So you talked about what happens when you learn to juggle, and other people, it kind of changes their lives in some ways. It allows you to focus, it allows you to let go. I almost saw it as a form of meditation. And I'm wondering, you know, is that part of the function that it plays in your life?
It can be.
Yeah.
And that's a great thing about juggling. I mean, it can be much anything. It can be also just like a wild way of like dancing to a song, and you do it while juggling.
Sure,
And when I say juggling, I don't just mean just three objects in the air. There's right. other juggling objects like yo-yos and tops and yeah. boxes and cups and hats. I mean, anything you can manipulate. It can be a form of meditation. It has been a form of meditation mm-hmm. for me. It's not that I don't think about other stuff while I'm doing it.
But there are different approaches to meditation. One is to become a blank slate and you don't interrupt it. But another approach is to hold something and to be able to really feel it in a new way.
Oh, absolutely. And I learned how to juggle blind.
Uh-huh.
Because I used to say it as a joke that I teach the person once who was blind how to juggle, and then I actually finally did. But I always said, like, is it possible? And what would that be like? What kind of sensation would you have when the whole visual aspect is gone? And juggling blindfold is as close as meditation as I get, because all I do is do nothing, basically.
Right.
Because the moment you start thinking about something else, then the whole pattern will fall apart. And I can't put my finger on it to how what it is,
right,
but you can learn how to juggle without looking at it.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. As you were growing up, did you have any kind of a practice that helped you to find your center? What I'm getting at here is the question that I usually close the show with, and we actually kind of bumped yeah. into it, was what do you do on a daily basis, weekly basis, monthly, yearly basis to restore yourself intellectually, emotionally, and physically? And what you described to take care of your isolated moments is a lot of those kinds of activities. But did you start that earlier in life? Is that something that got cultivated earlier and this blossomed later? How did you discover that?
I discovered that, like, you will spend a lot of time on your own in life,
uh-huh.
no matter how many lovely people you're surrounded with. And unfortunately, I don't know, I'm not really judging too much about it. I grew up a lot on my own. Mm-hmm. My parents were separated. My mom was a single mom. She worked two jobs. So I spent a lot of time on my own. And I don't know if I want to say since an early age I knew that I have to be able to entertain myself. But I do knew that it will take an effort on my end mm-hmm. to fill my day. And
right.
I strongly dislike the motion of blaming my surroundings for my own ability to be able to enjoy life to the fullest.
The locus of control yeah. is in yourself.
And so I'm a firm believer that, you know, luckily I'm also blessed with like growing up in the 21st century and being healthy and living in an industrialized country where one can express himself without being burned on a stick. So that all goes to my advantage. So it makes it a little bit easier for me than sure. for others perhaps. But that was also very important. I saw that from an early age. And some people call it even abandonment issues or something. But I also knew, some people have said, like, oh, because your parents didn't spend much time with you. And it's like, yeah, maybe that was the reason. But I do know that we are spending a lot of time on our own, a lot of time. And you better figure it out how to fill these moments and with productive and way that's satisfying and meaningful for yourself and hopefully for others as well.
Right. And you, what you describe is the exact opposite of the experience of so many children who are programmed so much that they never have to figure out how to take care of their own boredom or their own space.
It's very unfortunate. Yeah, don't get me started on the helmet culture.
On the what?
Helmet culture. And I see the reasons why, again, being mm-hmm. very empathetic to it, especially as a parent on my own, but I also do know the benefits of like being able to make your own experiences and choices and decisions and come to your own conclusions. I think that's almost more important.
Right. And what you describe is a balance of being able to be the entertainer, engaging a wide range of people and interacting with them afterwards, but also being able, with some comfort and resolve, to be alone.
Absolutely.
And people who have been damaged by that experience can't find that balance.
It's tough, and it's not, I mean, I make it also sound so easy because I get to choose my own words freely and so forth, and I'm in a good space, but it's difficult. I'm sure it is difficult, and people mm-hmm. struggle, and I don't want to take away with my easy answers from the struggle of others. And I'm sure I have them on my own. I just, for some reason, it has been working out for me, and uh-huh. Yeah, some people call it pragmatist or realist, but I do sort of know what works and what's important for me, and I can always draw from that.
And if it stops working, you can try something else.
I can try something else, and you know what? Luckily, I have so many people in my life that love me mm-hmm. so much more than I deserve, I think, at times, that it's another thing to fall back to. Right.
And the purpose of this conversation isn't to aggrandize what you've experienced. It's merely to state it, because as a culture, we don't talk openly about how we take care of ourselves very well.
Or openly, or listening for that
or
matter.
Or we don't listen to others.
I must say that's the first time I did a radio interview where the person hasn't asked me about the horrible things that have happened in my performance before. That's usually always a standard question. Yeah. Like sort of focusing on the dramatic, on the thing that sets it all apart, rather right. than focusing on the thing that has been worked consistently. We often focus on the few things that didn't work.
Right. And for me, I almost don't care about what happens on an individual day of your life
yeah.
unless it illustrates the bigger picture. And I did ask you, how has life worked out in a way that you didn't expect it to, that surprised you, that you weren't necessarily prepared for? And you made that response about discovering you're more conservative or less on the kind of leading edge of change. And you spoke to the big, what we call the secular trend, you know, in statistics or whatever. That's the deep movement that's going on, and not how you deal with the little stuff.
Oh, that's nice. Yeah, that's the way I like to look at it. Yeah.
So, yeah, and that's the point of the show, because and this, and how do you know in yourself when you are kind of beginning to kind of go off the rails a little bit? You need to step back and take a deeper look. What do you notice in yourself?
You do, and I mean, I must say that's why age is something I somewhat look forward to in a way, as mm-hmm. long as I can remember all the past experience to the extent where they're helpful for the future. But it does really do allow you to say, like, you know what, I've been here before, and I know exactly what happens with five different ways I can react to the situation.
Right. And two work and three really don't.
And I somewhat have a choice. Yeah, so let's sit back and make that choice. And don't be always too impulsive about things. It's totally fine to be rational about even emotions and so forth mm-hmm. and the way you express yourself. Because the moment you step outside your house, you do have an impact on this world.
Uh-huh. And even when you're inside your house, you have an impact on yourself.
Oh, absolutely. I remember I took a really beautiful class here once at Cornell, a dance class, and one of the exercises was to go through the day and do the opposite of every single physical reaction you had towards something. Like, for example, if somebody cuts you off in traffic, instead of giving him the finger, blowing him a kiss and open your arms.
I love you, yes.
You know, like, and just deal with the difference of reaction, what happens from them. And it was at this time, it was 20 years ago, it was mind-blowing. And it was like also so simple at the same time.
And 20 years ago, you were 30.
Yeah.
And that's kind of the beginning where people can really dive into the paradoxical imagination for a lot of people.
I hope it would be a few years earlier for
most
people.
It can be earlier, but it's often not. I mean, some of us get introduced because of certain issues into the paradox as teens or preteens. But in terms of just people gain more ability to play with it when they get a little bit older. It's not something that happens young.
Yeah, I mean, that's nice for you to articulate it. And I wish it would have been earlier, personally. Because you do.
But you did it as a child when you did not have parents to entertain you.
You did it with the tools you had. Yes. And, you know, and I look back at my childhood and I smile when I look back at my childhood. Even so, sometimes people hear the story itself and go, that sounds horrible. And I'm like, yes and no. I mean, I don't know, call it glass half full or not knowing better. For whatever reasons, I have always adopted a positive attitude, which you have to have as a performer, by the way.
Right. Right.
You cannot go out there thinking, oh my God, this is going to go down badly.
Right. Confidence means, is a word that's built around FI or FI.
Yeah.
Which is faith. And historically, yeah. Faith has meant hope and trust. You have an attitude that this will work out, and you trust that you have the skill to figure it out.
And I also have the knowledge that if it doesn't, I won't blame myself.
Yeah.
You know, I gave it my best shot.
Yeah.
You know, so.
Yeah. Hilby, it's been really good to get to know you.
Oh, thank you, Eric. Yeah. That was really fun. Thank you.
We're going to close with, how do you pronounce the seed?
Seed. Everything is beautiful. Yeah. That's a German singer in a band that sings English and German music. But it's called Beautiful, and it is beautiful. And the lyrics themselves, if you have a chance, listen to them. It's empowering.
Okay. Thank you. It's been great to get to know you.
Thank you, Eric.
Neon clouds, a light lime breeze, rose wine, honey, we've come clean. Somehow we found our song. You play the black, I play the white keys. The night falls to hush the voice. Purple flowers, shadows and turquoise. No satellite circles your sun, finding answers in the white noise. Waking up is beautiful when I am with you. And I wonder, yes, I wonder wisely that you choose. Everything is beautiful, heaven for a fool. And I wonder, girl, I wonder wisely that you choose. I'd be like this in the palm of your hand, happily speechless. You wear my shirt and just a devil's smile, bringing Mars closer to Venus. Late at night, I watch you sleep. You saved my life when no one believed. You gave up diamonds for Rolling Stone. Now I know what